This is podcast number 163 for the Well-Educated Mother's Heart. Hi, I'm Marlene Peterson. Today, we're talking about Albert Payson Terhune. I don't get to the nature side of the rotation schedule as much as I'd like to in these podcasts, but today I'd like to share a bit about Albert Payson Terhune. Before there was Lassie, there was Lad, a dog. A much-beloved classic about the love of a collie written largely from Albert's own experiences. He went on to write over 30 books, mostly about dogs. You'll find a link to the book in the animal section. Just fair warning, evidently there are parts of the book that are racist, but don't let that keep you away. Use it as a teaching moment of how people viewed different races in another time. Learn from it. I haven't had a chance to read the book yet, but I'm recommending it on the basis of how many generations have loved this book. I'll tell you something about Albert that made me appreciate him more. His first wife died when she was only 23 years old, 4 days after she gave birth to their daughter. They had only been married for 9 months. He eventually remarried but never had more children. I always make note of such things, even though they're very sad, as a reminder that people get through hard things, that there is life after tragedy, and I can't think of many sorrows harder than this one. But neither Albert nor his book are really the focus of this podcast. I want to tell you about his mother. Or rather, I'm going to have Albert tell you about his mother. I found an old magazine article written in October of 1926 entitled "Why I Think My Father and Mother Were Great" by Albert Payson Terhune. I'll let it speak for itself, and I'm just going to read the mother parts of this. My mother's father was a hidebound and craggy New Englander who left his Massachusetts home at 15 after thrashing his stepfather, so runs the family legend, and settled in Virginia. Her mother was a sweet and old-fashioned and prim little lady of Virginia, whose chief genius seems to have been for the incessant bearing and careful rearing of many children. Just such a woman as such a dour man would be likely to marry, I suppose. My mother was a dire disappointment to my grandmother. From the time she was 10 years old, she used to occupy her leisure time in scribbling stories in her copybook. This was an unheard-of form of mental perversion. Her mother hoped the child might outgrow it. When she was 14, my mother wrote a story called "Marrying Through Prudential Motives," and she sent it to a $50 prize contest that was waging in Godey's Lady Book. This was in 1845, an era when respectable young girls were no more supposed to write for publication than they were supposed to go into the prize ring. She did not wish to disgrace her family by writing the tale under her own name, on the off chance that it might be printed and her shame blazoned to the world. So she hit on the pen name that thereafter was hers. Her name was Mary Hawes, Mary Virginia Hawes. She kept the initials of her first and last names and used them for a nom de plume, which would sound as much as possible like the original without betraying her identity. Plus, so she would be able to tell her girlfriends, in secret, that she was the author of the story, with some chance of being believed. Hence, she evolved from Mary Hawes to the pseudonym Marion Harland. My mother did not send her address with the story, nor stamps for its return. 6 months later, she saw in Godey's Lady Book an announcement that Marion Harland had won the contest's first prize of $50 and a request that she send her address. "What did you do with the $50?" I asked when she told me about it. "I spent half of it on a black silk dress for my mother," she answered, "and gave the other half anonymously to our church's building fund. You see, I had a feeling I had done something wicked and that it would be wrong to profit by it." My grandmother's pleasure, if any, in the silk dress did not balance her horror at her 14-year-old daughter's sin. She lectured her severely and weepingly on the unwomanliness of writing stories, and besought her never again to yield to such an unworthy temptation. For 2 solid years, my mother was so oppressed with a sense of guilt that she did not write another word. She told me those were the two unhappiest years of her life. Story plots kept bubbling into her brain, and her fingers itched to set them down in words. The strain told on her health. In a moment of confidence, she confessed to her father the sinful yearning of her heart to go on writing, and she asked him how best to overcome it. He demanded that she hunt up any of her stories she might still have kept and show them to him. He spent a whole evening reading them in his study. Late that night, he finished the heap of scribbled manuscripts and went up to her room with them. She woke to see him standing at the foot of her bed. "Daughter," said the grim old Presbyterian, "you can serve God and mankind as worthily with a gift like yours as you could by going as a missionary to the heathen. God gave you the rare power to write. You would be ungrateful to him if you neglected it. Go on with your work." From then to his death, he read and reread every word she wrote and looked upon her with a queer awe. She alone of his army of children did not fear him and had no need to. When she was 18, she finished her first novel alone. In Presbyterian Richmond in the late 1840s, novel reading was done in secret, for the most part. Such books usually were kept from the young. Trembling, my mother took a loan to a local publisher. He rejected it. She went to a northern publisher, who sent it back almost by return mail. Then she told her father what she had done. He read the book's manuscript all of one business day and late into the night. Next morning he took it to the Richmond publisher, who had refused it, and bade him issue a goodly edition of it and to send him the bill. My mother told me that she lay awake all that night, wondering if her father would get back a penny of his wild investment. The novel passed the 100,000 mark in an age when large book sales were pitiably few. Longfellow and young Aldrich and Whittier and M.P. Willis wrote glowingly congratulatory letters about it to the unknown girl, letters she treasured all her long life. She had arrived. Thenceforward, the road was clear. Book followed book. All of them were successful. She and my father met at a dinner in Richmond. Each was 24. Each disliked the other at sight. My father had said he had a contempt for women who wrote books. My mother heard of this. She had said she would sooner die than marry a clergyman, and that my father had the ugliest jaw she had seen on a man. That was nearly 20 years before I was born, with a jaw that matched it line for line. Kind friends carried this absurd speech to him. A year later, he and she were married. They came to New Jersey to live, to Newark, which in that day was well nigh as straight-laced as Richmond. It was when I was still a small child that my mother's lungs broke down, and we went to Europe to stay for several years. It was during this time that I drove my mother almost to desperation. It happened in Rome. We had a furnished apartment there on the Piazza di Spagna. My mother was a splendid disciplinarian, and she was rigidly careful, besides, as to my diet and sleep hours. I rebelled often and fruitlessly at this restraint. I used to cite the happy children who were allowed to sit up till 10 o'clock at night, and to eat pastry and candy and the like, and who were not forced to eat hideous oatmeal porridge at breakfast, or be in bed at 7. In irritation once, my mother answered, "When I am gone, you'll have a pretty stepmother with golden hair and blue eyes, and she'll let you sit up as late as you want and eat everything you like, and she will give you pounds of candy a day." She spoke in vexed joke, and I think more for the benefit of my father than for myself. But the mischief was done. My boyish imagination took hold. Instead of bursting into tears at chance of losing her, I was thrilled to the very soul at the prospect she had painted for me. Of course I loved my mother, and of course I didn't want her to die, but she had to die. Well, golden hair and blue eyes were a grand combination, and the pretty stepmother would let me sit up all night if I wanted to, and she would feed me heaps of candy and let me have Italian pastry for breakfast and all manner of other heavenly food. That began it. I knew my mother was truthful. She never broke her word. She had promised me this fascinating and generous stepmother. Therefore, the stepmother must soon appear, her white arms laden with rich gifts for me, mostly things to eat. Of course, this couldn't happen while my mother lived. But morning after morning, I ran to my mother's room as soon as I was awake to peer keenly at her over the foot of the bed and to ask how she was feeling. Sometimes, very tactfully, for I began to see it was not a popular theme of discourse with her, I would seek to lure her into even more detailed descriptions of the stepmother, who by this time had become clothed by my flaming imagination with all the most desirable aspects of Santa Claus. Could I have a saddle horse and a collie dog of my very own, did she suppose? Of course, not right now, but when... She told me years afterward that my ghoulishly speculative glares at her and my incessant hints about the beautiful stepmotherly times ahead did more to arouse in her an angry resolution to live than did all the climate and medicines. She had gone to Europe to die. Every doctor said so, and on that ground they had advised my father against taking her thither. Stubbornly he had insisted, declaring he was going to bring her back alive and well. His forecast came true. She returned to America at last, in splendid health, and she remained so for another 40 years. It was before that first European sojourn, and before her health broke down, that she won another battle in regard to her writing, a battle almost as arduous as the one my grandfather had helped her through. She was the best housekeeper, except my own wife, that I have known. This is a day when cookbooks were few and semi-useless, and when housewives perforce turned to their elders for culinary lore. She decided to write a cookbook which could be understood and followed by the newest bride or the stupidest servant. She wrote it. She called it Common Sense in the Household. I believe that something close to 500,000 copies of it have been sold first and last. Then came the struggle to get it published. Long since, her many novels have found a ready and growing market, but this was a different matter. Her own publishers would not touch the new venture. They and other experts said there was no possible sell for a cookbook, and that the volume must be a lamentable failure. At length, she took the unwanted cookbook to Charles Scribner, Sr. He accepted it, not as he confessed to her later on that he had any idea it would sell 12 copies, but in the hope that his publishing of it would induce her to let him bring out her next novel. At once, Common Sense in the Household justified her belief in it. It did more. It condemned its author to be known henceforth as a writer on domestic topics instead of a novelist, and to build her future fame on what had been a mere experiment. "It isn't literature, this household stuff I write," she told me once, with a whimsical resignation. "I know that, but it is influence, and it helps people. Perhaps that is even more worthwhile than to feel that my next novel is looked forward to by those same people." Yet I knew it galled her, unspeakably, that a younger generation should look upon her as a kind of supercook, and not as a popular novelist. She bore it pluckily, even gaily, as was her way, and she made the most of it, but always it hurt. She kept on with her novels, too, and even won for herself a merited fame as a biographer. But primarily from that time on, she was known to the public at large only as an authority on household themes. To me, there is a glint of tragedy in that. She won her campaign for the betterment of American homes, but in winning it, she threw away her high vogue as a fiction writer. 2 more successful battles on a smaller scale marked her afterlife. At 73, she broke her right wrist. Never did it mend enough for her to write again by hand, except for a very few scrawling words at a stretch. At that age, for the first time, she bought and mastered a typewriting machine, presently using it as fast and as well as many a professional typist, and learning to compose on it as readily as once she had written by pen. That by itself was something of a victory for a woman of her age, I think. At 90, she went blind. We told her it was a double cataract, and that soon she could be operated on and would see as well as ever. But it was not a cataract. It was an incurable form of blindness. Unwilling to wait with her hands folded in her lap for the supposed operation, she hired a secretary and taught herself to dictate. She dictated an entire novel, The Carringtons of High Hill, and numberless household articles in the remaining 18 months of her life. To me, that seems her supreme triumph, for the work was vigorous and excellent, showing no sign of its author's great age nor of her unaccustomed new medium of expression. She was the hardest and most conscientious worker imaginable. I do not believe there was a weekday, a month, year after year, on which she did not average at least 7 busy hours at her desk, besides superintending every detail of the household. Neither the quality of the work nor that of the home suffered in any way by this dual achievement. When I say she spent 7 hours at her desk, I don't mean she sat there mooning or fidgeting or chatting, but that she was writing every minute and with every ounce of energy and concentration she possessed. She endured, from us children or from the servants or from visitors, an incessant bombardment of interruptions which would send me insane, or which, at the very least, would shatter for the whole day my ability to do acceptable or even coherent work. Never have I seen her lose her none-too-placid temper at such interruptions. Always, if they were justified, and often if they were not, she would attend to whatever detail of business was brought up by them, and then would go back to her work, joining its frayed threads where they had been broken off. I dropped in to see her at dusk, past her 89th birthday. She was resting. "I'm a little tired," she told me. "I was at my desk 9 solid hours today. There was an article the editors wanted in a hurry." "Yes, I'm really tired," she added worriedly. "Do you suppose it is a sign I'm getting old?" There were 6 of us children to begin with. 3 of us lived past childhood. I was the youngest, being born on my mother's 42nd birthday. She used to say she and I were twins. Apart from her manifold other labors, she taught all of us to read and write, and prepared us for school so thoroughly along every branch of study that we entered classes with children 2 or 3 years older than we. I should like to brag that we continued to hold the gratifying scholastic start she gave us, but in my own case it would not be true. I slipped back with startling promptitude. As to our home life during my childhood, looking back on it over the lapse of many years, the only real flaw I can recall is my mother's insistence that we be at the breakfast table at a most ungodly early hour. She herself was up and about by daybreak. She had no love at all for sleep, and she had only a puzzled scorn for those who enjoyed it, said my father to me, half mournfully, when I had incurred disgrace, as usual, through oversleeping. "Your dear mother is ready to believe that God's mercy is wide enough to embrace all ordinary sinners, but she is quite certain there is no forgiveness either in heaven or on earth for anyone who lies in bed after 7 in the morning." She outlived my father by 15 years, though she had always declared most positively that he would outlive her. Less than a year before his death, he and she celebrated their golden wedding at Sunnybank, the home they had bought and built and loved in the early days of their married life, the home that now is mine. Bye-bye. See you next time.